You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the history of science, there have been a number of events, like the discovery of microbes, the development of antibiotics, and the unraveling of the human genome, that have fundamentally changed our lives and the trajectory of medicine. Stem cells are increasingly looking like they may hold the key to the next breakthrough that could change everything. Senior Time magazine science writer Alice Park has written a book called The Stem Cell Hope. It's published by Hudson Street Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Now, you call the stem cell the cellular fountain of youth. What qualities give it that degree of potential?
Well, think about the treatments that we have today for our diseases, for diabetes. We know what the issue is there, that diabetes patients cannot make insulin. So we give them insulin. We provide them with insulin. We know their cells are deficient in some way, but we provide them this insulin. Think about heart patients. Their cells are dying, but we bypass them. We bypass areas where there's clots. So the idea behind stem cell research is a cell-based treatment. And this means that we're going to give patients who are deficient or who have diseased cells healthy new cells. And that's the whole idea behind stem cell research and regenerative medicine.
But we can't just give them anybody's cells. We're giving them their own cells.
Well, that's the ultimate goal. So stem cell research began with the idea that you first need to understand what these cells are and how to make them what you need them to be. How do you make a stem cell into a heart cell or into an insulin-producing cell?
They start off as blank slates?
They start off as blank slates. These are the very same cells that you and I started out with when we were just a few days old. Everyone has these cells, and through very complex, instructions and developmental pathways, we become who we are. And trying to trace back those steps is what stem cell researchers are doing today.
Is it particularly difficult to turn an embryonic stem cell into a nerve cell or a heart cell?
Well, that's the state at which we are right now. So research, that is the challenge. Generating the cells, they tell me, is a lot easier than the steps that you just mentioned, turning them into the specific cells that we want. And once we get there, too, we also need to test them and make sure that they're functioning the way we want them to function. So those are the challenges that lay ahead. But most people feel that those are surmountable challenges.
We want them to grow but not turn into cancer.
That's correct. So the idea is to understand what helps differentiation, which is the very specific growth, proper growth, versus just simple proliferation, which is what happens in a cancer tumor.
Something called induced pluripotent stem cells have also been isolated recently. What are they?
These are the sort of exciting holy grail in the field. So embryonic stem cells come from embryos. And to this day, we do not know how to take a human cell and turn its clock back and generate an embryonic stem cell from a specific patient. So if I were to take one of your cells, we would not be able to turn one of those cells into an embryonic stem cell.
And the political problem is that if we use real embryos, some people are concerned about that, even though there have been arguments that many of those embryonic stem cells would come from embryos that will be destroyed.
Right. So at this moment, what we do is we take embryonic stem cells from existing embryos, and these come from the IVF process. So IVF embryos that the couples decide that they don't need anymore, that's where our embryonic stem cells come from.
Do we know whether these IPS cells, the induced pluripotent, I'm going to call them IPS from now on, induced pluripotent stem cells that have been isolated recently are as pliable as embryonic stem cells?
They believe so, but there is some evidence that it's going to take a few more years before we really fully understand how like embryonic stem cells these are. And that's why it's important to continue the embryonic stem cell research. A lot of people have argued that because we now have these iPS cells, which we can take from your skin cell and turn back the clock and turn it into a stem cell. People argue that once we can do this, why do we need embryonic stem cells? But we still need to be able to compare these iPS cells to embryonic stem cells.
And you're saying creating these iPS cells are pretty easy? Couldn't any graduate student do it?
According to the scientists, it's on the scale of things that they do, it's ranks on the easier side, that any person with a molecular biology background can take these four factors, which Shinya Yamanaka, the Japanese scientist who first discovered these cells, did, and turn a skin cell, for example, or any other adult cell, into an embryo-like cell.
And then treat my Parkinson's or my diabetes or... There are a lot of people who have spinal cord injuries who consider stem cell research to be a key to dealing with their problem.
That's right. So then the next steps are where we are right now, which is now taking that embryo-like cell and saying, okay, what are the signals this cell needs to become a nerve cell that will then help a spinal cord injury patient walk again or a diabetic patient to come off his or her insulin?
Well, I noticed that you've called your book The Stem Cell Hope, not The Stem Cell Promise, or even better, The Stem Cell Cure. How close are we to actually coming up with any kind of practical application? I remember some years ago when, during the Bush administration ban on embryonic stem cell research, a politician told some of the people in the field, if you just come up with some kind of dramatic breakthrough, we can get past this. But nobody's come up with a dramatic breakthrough even after the rules were changed.
Well, the rules were just changed in 2009. So science occurs in stages. And right now we are making really great strides. We've got two clinical trials approved by the FDA. The first one's using embryonic stem cells to see if they can treat disease, one for spinal cord injury and one for macular degeneration and eye diseases.
Are those the most promising areas at the moment?
Those are the most promising areas, and they believe that actually the eye diseases might prove to be prove to yield results much faster than the spinal cord injury, because that is a very unique kind of part of the body where the immune cells are sort of protected, or the cells are protected from the immune system. So they believe that we might see results there sooner than we might in the spinal cord cases.
And the reason for spinal cord is that nerve cells don't regenerate on their own, so we have to create new nerve cells to get past the injury?
Right. The idea is that those cells are not signaling and becoming part of the network that talks to other nerve cells in your legs or in your arms. And therefore, we need to regenerate those cells and help to improve that communication.
How might that be done? Are they just going to inject them into a spine and watch them grow? Will we take it in pill form?
What they're injecting are not the stem cells themselves, but what they're injecting are specific cells called oligodendrocytes. And these are the cells that sort of enhance the communication between nerves. So, yes, the idea is to really inject them in the areas where they might do the most work and have the most effect.
My guest is Alice Park, who's a senior science writer for Time magazine. She's been covering stem cell research for the past 15 years, and now she's written a book called The Stem Cell Hope: How Stem Cell Medicine Can Change Our Lives. It is published by Hudson Street Press. I was told by some stem cell people that perhaps the more immediate application would be in detecting conditions, using stem cells as a way, the sort of thing that we do to find out whether somebody is HIV positive.
Well, the first, I think, application of stem cell research will be in what some people call disease in a dish. So if you think about conditions like Parkinson's, we often see patients once they come in advanced disease. Their whatever process has contributed to that condition has already been in place, and it's already occurred, and we're seeing sort of the late and after effects of all of that. So the idea with stem cell research is, if you could create those motor neurons from a stem cell in a dish and watch it grow into the motor neuron and watch its development, you might be able to see where it starts to go awry, and you might be able to get a better understanding at what processes you can target with what drugs, and therefore come up with more effective treatments.
Well, in some cases, we're talking about diseases or illnesses, conditions, whatever, that have a genetic component. But in some cases, there are also environmental causes. This could get pretty complicated.
of course, it can get complicated, and that's the nature of disease. But if you're able to see this disease occur, you will be able to, at certain points, intervene and see whether the genes are involved, whether it's an interaction between genes and other factors in the environment, or just the process of development that results in whatever deficits contribute to a condition like Parkinson's.
How fast, you mentioned that the rules were changed just 2 years ago, but people were working in independent labs and they were funded independently. So the research has been moving along all of these years, but how fast is the pace of stem cell research moving these days now that the rules have been changed a bit?
It's moving even faster, and that's what I found fascinating as I was covering this field, and what really prompted me to write the book was the fact that the science was really progressing despite the social and political environment that really hampered it for so many years under the Bush administration. The strides that we've made in terms of understanding what stem cells are, in terms of being able to generate the iPS cells at all, this is a field that's only about a decade old. And if you think about where we were 10 years ago and where we are today, and even being able to talk about the idea of a disease in a dish or to talk about treatments and, being able to alleviate diseases in patients, it's a pretty remarkable thing.
Some states have encouraged labs to do this. Is that where most of the work is being done?
A lot of the work to
Missouri, I think, was one of them.
Yes. A lot of work to date has been done in privately funded labs, universities that have been able to raise private funds. There are institutes and foundations that have focused on stem cell research to sort of fill in the gap when the NIH wasn't able to. And also some of the work has come from abroad, as people had feared at the beginning of the Bush administration when the restrictions first went into place, that a lot of the international scientists who have the funding and who have government support have been able to step in.
But a lot of scientists were leaving to work in labs abroad. Does this remain a political hot potato in this country?
Well, we currently still have a lawsuit against the U.S. government, and this dates back to 1996 to a law that was passed that prevented the creation and harm of embryos for research purposes. And at the time, the NIH and Harold Varmus, the head of the NIH, was able to, get the counsel of the NIH, the lawyer, to really look at the issue and come up with a statement saying that these stem cells were not embryos. And that was what the NIH used as it continued to fund its research. Now, that has become an issue today as several groups have sued the U.S. government and sued the NIH, saying that that was a wrongful interpretation of the law.
Which is the Dickey-Wicker Amendment?
That's correct.
And what did that law say?
So the Dickey-Wicker Amendment is the law that was passed that prevented the creation and harm of embryos for research purposes.
We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. My guest is Alice Park. Her book, The Stem Cell Hope, How Stem Cell Medicine Can Change Our Lives, is published by Hudson Street Press. Stay with us. We're back with Alice Park, who is a senior science writer at Time Magazine. She's been covering the stem cell research story for 15 years now. And she's written a book called The Stem Cell Hope, How Stem Cell Medicine Can Change Our Lives. It's published by Hudson Street Press. What do stem cells look like in a lab?
They actually don't look like very much. If you were to see them, they just sort of coat the bottom of a regular old Petri dish, and they just look almost like, little white cloudy stains on the bottom of the dish.
Do they require much attention from technicians?
They do. The people who take care of these cells really say that they can't go on vacation. They're like children because they require constant feeding. And because they tend to grow very well, if you get a good line, you need to split them apart so that they don't overcrowd their plate and, start starving to death.
Because they're competing for nutrients?
They are competing for nutrients. And once they start growing, they can grow really quickly. And the other issue with stem cells is that they can also start developing randomly into you know, a nerve cell or whatever it might be. And you want to pick those out so that you get really a pure colony of just stem cells.
HIV/AIDS was first isolated 30 years ago, but doctors are now claiming that one HIV patient, Timothy Ray Brown, has been cured by receiving stem cells from a man who's immune to HIV. Is there reason to be encouraged by that?
Mr. Brown's case is a bone marrow transplant, which has been in place for many years as a treatment for cancer, for blood cancers.
And it hasn't always worked. It's been one of the more problematic treatments.
That's right. And it's been problematic for breast cancer as well. It was very talked about initially as a breast cancer treatment, and insurance companies wouldn't fund it because there wasn't enough evidence to show that it really had any effect. So Mr. Brown's case is one where he received a bone marrow transplant specifically from someone who had antibodies or what they believed to be an ability to fight HIV. In his case, it worked. But there's no guarantee that it'll work in other cases, and there's no guarantee that you'll be able to find those people, the right people, to transplant.
So, right, there have been no other attempts to do this, to duplicate it?
Not to my knowledge. And he's one of the lucky ones, and we also the doctors can't explain whether it was the cells that he received from the donor or whether it was some combination of his body's response with the cells. It's still unclear.
Well, we do know that there's some people who are naturally immune to HIV. So couldn't we just go to them, take a little piece of their skin, and start a line of stem cells?
I'm sure that's what many in the HIV field are doing right now. And that's the potential. That's the hope that stem cells represent is, so far, people have been trying to find that factor among what they call those long-term non-progressors. So they're looking in the blood, they're looking in their tissues, they're looking in their immune system. They're trying to find that factor, and they haven't been able to isolate it yet. But if we were to take, as you say, a stem cell from one of those people and watch that cell grow and develop it into an immune cell or a blood cell or whatever it might be, we might be able to find some clues, some hints as to what it is that's helping those people prevent infection.
A group of scientists in Japan are now discussing whether blood stem cell transplants would help workers exposed to radiation at the Fukushima nuclear plant. What are they proposing?
They're proposing the same idea that's behind bone marrow transplants. And these are
what we need matches in all cases.
That's right. And these are what we would call adult stem cells. So these are not cells that we would need to obtain either from embryos or create using the iPS technology. These are the same way we would treat leukemia patients, cancer patients with bone marrow transplants. We would ablate their blood system and inject them with bone marrow from a donor, a matched donor, and allow them to rebuild their blood and bone system.
We've known about stem cells for a long time, but they were only isolated in 1998 by James Thompson. How was he able to do that?
It's a very interesting story. He's actually in primate biology, and he had become an expert in embryogenesis among primates. So it occurred to him that there would be a way, after hearing about Dolly, it occurred to him that there would be a way to really get embryonic stem cells from an embryo.
This is Dolly the clone sheep.
That's correct.
Not Dolly the painter.
No. Dolly the clone sheep, who was the first mammal to be cloned. So it occurred to Thompson that, you know, he would be able to extract these cells. It took him a while, and working by himself in a very small lab at the University of Wisconsin. But he was able to extract the cells, and the key was to get them to grow.
And many people who are opposed to cloning have lumped it together with stem cell research. Are they one and the same thing?
Well, you can take a stem cell. There's a way to get stem cells that involves cloning, and this is the way that Dolly the sheep was created, which is you can take an egg, take out its nucleus, which means take out all its DNA, so it's just basically a shell, and insert another cell, a skin cell, from, you know, another individual, what they call a donor, and this skin cell obviously would have its own DNA. So that DNA would then take over in the egg and create a copy of that individual, that donor. And that's how Dolly was created.
Because if you just take the cell and insert it, you only have a female egg. You'd need the male part as well. But when you take it from something that already exists, that's already been done.
Right. So the idea is that the egg has only half the chromosomes that you would need. But if you were to take out that egg's DNA and insert the DNA of a new cell, which has its full complement of DNA, and then subject it to some chemical and electrical processes, you're able to get it to start dividing as if it had been fertilized.
Now, that's cloning. What about in vitro fertilization? Are there any connections there?
In vitro fertilization is the process by which you can basically fertilize an egg outside of the womb. So what would normally occur inside a woman's womb is now occurring in a dish. So you extract eggs from a female donor and you inject sperm and allow it to fertilize and start dividing for a few days, and then you implant that growing embryo back into the womb.
Now, the debate over embryonic stem cell research has been caught up in the almost intractable fight over abortion in this country. Was that something that was even considered in the early days of the discovery?
It was, and I think the problem with the way that embryonic stem cell was viewed here in the U.S. was that it was very quickly co-opted into the abortion debate. And so there's still a lot of confusion over where embryonic stem cells come from. You know, do they come from aborted fetuses? And they don't, because it's actually too late. If a fetus has already developed, there aren't enough embryonic stem cells really to extract. So this occurs way before that point. And at the beginning, researchers were really extracting these cells from embryos that couples had decided they no longer needed.
Now, where are most medical ethicists on this issue? Are they divided as well?
I think there's a little less division than there are among politicians over the efficacy of this and over the ethics of this, because many of the ethicists see the issue as one of, if the embryos are going to be discarded anyway, would it not be better to have them used for research that could help people, you know, other people in the future? Some ethicists also, however, do take a strong position, saying that, as conservatives do, that all embryos that are created are a form of life, and they would rather have them destroyed and discarded than subject them to, you know, the process by which you have to remove the stem cells.
But if you're discarding them, destroying them, aren't you also killing them? I'm not sure I understand the fine line there.
I'm not sure a lot of people do either, but for them it is a line, a very fine one, but it's an important one for them. But yes, you do have to destroy the embryo in order to extract the cells.
Alice Park's book, The Stem Cell Hope, How Stem Cell Medicine Can Change Our Lives, is published by Hudson Street Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You begin your book with the story of Douglas Melton, who's currently the co-director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, but started his career in early amphibian development. What led to his career change?
Well, Doug Melton is a very well-respected scientist and a wonderful man. He began and was starting to get a very good reputation in the field as a frog embryologist, understanding reproduction in frogs and amphibians. And then his son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes as an infant when he was 6 months old. And this really had a huge effect on both Doug as well as his wife. And they decided at that point that there was something that he could do that to better understand this disease. Stem cells weren't really a big thing at that juncture, but he decided that he needed to devote his scientific career to understanding type 1 diabetes and trying to find a cure for his son.
And he thought he could do it through stem cell research?
Soon after he made that decision, he came upon this new emerging field of stem cell research, and decided that this was the way that he could really open the door to better understanding the disease.
And you note that his laboratory became a scientific asylum for many years. Is that because of the restrictions of the Bush administration?
Yes. So at Harvard, what they did was, based on his very strong recommendation and support from the university administration, they created a lab purely with private funding that could work on embryonic stem cell research. And the way that scientists at the time were interpreting the Bush restrictions was that they did not want to jeopardize any of the other university funding by perhaps buying a pen with government grant money, or, you know, paying for the electricity bill with government grant money.
So, or using the same tape in two labs, I was told.
Exactly. And so they had stickers on what was purchased with private funds and what was purchased with government funds.
And they had to keep the laboratories totally separated from each other. Because there was concern that somebody might say, well, you're using the same person in two labs, and that undermines government support. But the government did allow some stem cell lines. I never understood why those lines and not other lines.
Well, the distinction that Bush made in August when he made his announcement in 2001 was that all lines that were already in existence and that researchers were already using, those lines would be okay because they were already there. And if he had put a complete ban on embryonic stem cell research with government funds, that would mean that all of that work would have to stop and those researchers would have to find additional funding in order to continue their studies.
But scientists complained that some of those lines were already deteriorating or had been contaminated. And so there were very few that they could actually work with. Do we know how many lines there are today?
There are nearly 200 lines today that have been approved in the NIH registry. And these are the result of President Obama's 2009 decision to allow embryonic stem cell lines created from excess IVF embryos to be used for government-funded research.
Now, is human stem cell research all that different from stem cell research in other areas? I'm going back to Doug Melton, who was studying frogs, and I wonder whether you could do apply stem cell thinking to frogs, frog that's born with – because right now frogs are dying out. We might want to do something – to help them revive their population.
You can. And actually, most scientists think of shifting the research the other way around, starting with mice or amphibians and applying that knowledge to human cells. But presumably, there's no reason why you wouldn't be able to find the same types of cells in different species and to do what you're suggesting.
The Bush administration's restrictions on federal funding did lead to major political and scientific backlashes. California voters approved $3 billion in stem cell funding in 2004, but then the labs were never built.
In California?
Yeah.
They were built in California, and the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine has really been a watershed and a pioneer in a new type of funding for research, particularly this kind of research where it's so controversial. Nearly every one of the California research universities now receives funding from CIRM, as it's called, and it has already begun to fund some very important work in the field in both using embryonic stem cells as well as the newer iPS cells.
Well, what does current polling say about America's attitudes towards stem cell research?
I think there's still a segment of the population that is uncomfortable with the idea that stem cells come from embryos. And I don't think this is a comfort that we're going to convince them to, you know, to give up. This is a very fundamental, this is an ethical and moral issue for many people, and it's a very fundamental belief that you should not be researching and doing research on embryonic tissues.
And this is not simply a Democrat-Republican thing. For example, Nancy Reagan is a strong supporter of stem cell research, isn't she?
That's correct. And there are a lot of conservatives, such as Orrin Hatch, too, in the Congress, who are also supporters of stem cell research. But there are people who believe very strongly that embryos should not be experimented on and their tissues are not proper material for scientific research. But by and large, I think most Americans, when they're provided with the information that these are embryos that would be discarded anyway in the IVF process, don't have much of a problem with them being used to potentially lead to new treatments for a much larger group of people.
The story of stem cell breakthroughs had a few twists. In 2004, South Korean researcher Hwang Woo-suk announced that he had generated the first human embryonic stem cells from healthy people, and that turned out not to be true. I always wonder why scientists make these claims when they know that in time people are going to not be able to duplicate them.
That is the big question, is that clearly at some point he knew that something wasn't right with his studies, and why keep up the charade? But that was a very disappointing turn in the stem cell story. What he had done was basically take the same process that had created Dolly, taking that egg, a human egg, and taking a skin cell from another human donor and inserting it into the egg and trying to see if he could get a embryo-like thing to develop and then extract embryonic stem cells from them. He claimed he had done that. It turns out that he hadn't, that it turns out through some complicated misunderstandings or intentional, obfuscations with people who he was collaborating with, that those stem cell lines that he thought had been cloned that way actually came from IVF embryos.
There's always a fear that the development of a new technology, no matter how promising, will have a dark side. And are there potential dark sides to stem cell research?
Well, I think, as you say, that any technology does have that potential. And the idea that you can take a skin cell and turn back its clock so that it can become any type of cell, and ideally, if the South Korean scientists had been proven correct, into a whole new human being, I mean, that worries a lot of people. And clearly that has a lot of potential, for a dark side. But I don't think that that has ever stopped science. And if you talk to the researchers in the field, they're fully aware of that as well. And they're fully aware of the moral and ethical implications and consequences of their work. So they do discuss this, and I think, but they also realize that that shouldn't be a reason that we hold back the science and stick our heads in the sand.
There were lots of warnings when we decoded the human genome that it could be abused. So far, we haven't seen any abuses.
Well, there was
of course there's always a possible abuse somewhere down the line.
That's right. And there was a lot of concern about particularly, a type of bioterrorism, if people were able to manipulate the genome and create super strains of bugs or whatever it might be. And there was a great effort at the time when the technology to sort of splice together genes and mix and match genes came out. There was a great effort by leading scientists to really put a voluntary moratorium on the research until they could come up with some guidelines for how to do the work.
I mentioned that politician who said just one breakthrough and everything would change. Do you think that people would change their minds if Parkinson's, for example, were cured as a result of stem cell research?
Imagine what would happen if we had someone who had a spinal cord injury who received some stem cell transplants and was able to walk. Or imagine someone with type 1 diabetes who was able to receive insulin-producing cells and no longer needed to prick their finger every several hours and no longer needed insulin. That's a very powerful thing, and I think that's right. I think the first person who will benefit from stem cell research will really change the landscape.
Alice Park's book is called The Stem Cell Hope, How Stem Cell Medicine Can Change Our Lives. It's published by Hudson Street Books or Hudson Street Press. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.